the headline, Saudi Arabia steps up its airstrikes on Yemen, hitting the capital Sana'a and a northern grain port, which is a UN-brokered neutral zone. Israel revokes the VIP permit of Palestine's foreign minister following his meeting with the ICC's chief prosecutor over the body's probe into Israeli war crimes. And severe floods in Australia's most populous state of New South Wales forces the evacuation of nearly 20,000 people. Our top story for this half hour, the Saudi-led coalition waging a war on Yemen since 2015 has unleashed dozens of fresh airstrikes against the impoverished nation. The coalition says it has pounded military positions in the capital, Sana'a, and the port of Salif on the Red Sea coast. But the United Nations says some civilian areas also came under attack. According to the UN, a grains port in Salif, as well as a warehouse and a food production company, were targeted. The raids have violated a 2018 agreement brokered by the UN that designates the port of Salif as a neutral zone. Yemen's Ansar Allah movement has slammed the attack, saying that these were part of Saudi Arabia's economic warfare against Yemenis. Saudi Arabia has imposed a sea and air blockade on Yemen, which has badly hampered humanitarian efforts to save civilian lives in Yemen. Activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Bukhaiti says the Saudi raids on Yemen show the kingdom's desperation.
Actually, what is silly from the UN observer who are in Hodeidah at this time, they say there was two strike, and then they have not actually mentioned or say Saudi or coalition strike. They left it as if something is unknown. Nobody knows where this strike come from, and to show you that the United Nations actually try so hard not to mention Saudi in any of their statement. And yesterday there was about 5 airstrike on the capital Sana'a. They have targeted the so-called military maintenance. This area, central Sana'a, has been targeted, I think, from the beginning of the war with maybe 80 to 70 airstrike, and there is nothing in that area, only old truck, old military vehicles, some banned tires at that area. That's why there was a huge fire at that place where the strikes took place. And to be honest with you, that all those strikes actually shows that the Saudi actually has not got anything to bring to the battle, only to target every now and then the capital Sana'a, and to keep target many civilians area.
Israel has revoked the VIP permit of the Palestinian foreign minister after his return from a trip to the Hague-based International Criminal Court, which is probing war crimes against the regime. The revocation of the VIP status means Riyad al-Maliki will need Israel's permission for any future travel abroad. Last week, Maliki met with the ICC's chief prosecutor to demand she speeds up an investigation into Israel's war crimes in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. He also called on the court to end the era of impunity and start the path of accountability for Israel. The investigation is expected to look into the 2014 Israeli war on Gaza, killing of Palestinians along Israeli barriers separating Gaza with occupied territories, as well as the regime's illegal settlements on Palestinian lands. Israel has fiercely opposed the probe. Our correspondent in the occupied West Bank, Mona Candela, has given us the latest on Israel's revocation of the Palestinian foreign minister's VIP status.
There is no official statement from the Israeli regime on the issue. However, Israeli media were quoting some Israeli officials saying that Riyad al-Maliki wanted, with the with the Palestinian Authority, to work with the ICC in order to harm Israeli senior officials and to prevent their freedom of movement. This is why the Israelis revoked the VIP card. Let's remind our viewers that there is no airport, or the only means for the Palestinians to leave the occupied West Bank is through an Israeli border controlled by the Israeli officials between Jordan and the occupied territories. Now, the Palestinian Authority said that it collected numerous files that would help the ICC investigators in order to prosecute Israeli officials, because Israel is not a member, so they cannot, the ICC can't prosecute Israel as a state or a regime. However, they can prosecute and bring to trials Israeli senior officials, Israeli soldiers, and even Israeli ministers, with making proofs and bringing proofs that those Israeli officials committed crimes against Palestinians.
Days of rainfall is wreaking havoc in Australia's most populous state of New South Wales, with authorities planning to evacuate thousands more people from low-lying Sydney suburbs.
There are around 15,000 people who've been evacuated from the mid-north coast from their homes. In the Nepean Richmond Valley region, or Hawkesbury region, there have been about 3,000 evacuations to date. 19 evacuation orders have been issued, and potentially more to come.
The government has also declared a natural disaster in large swaths of the state, where unrelenting rains have caused widespread damage. On Sunday, authorities issued evacuation orders for the city of Sydney after its largest dam overflowed, inundating a large area. No human casualties have been reported so far. This is the worst flooding for Sydney and other areas along Australia's east coast in 60 years. Weather forecasters warn of more rains over the next few days in New South Wales. A severe flood warning has also been issued for neighboring Queensland. On this news, where two British police officers have been injured after protests against a controversial parliamentary bill turned violent in the city of Bristol.
Everyone's in that way.
The demonstrators also vandalized a police station and set some vehicles ablaze after thousands hit the streets defying COVID-19 restrictions. The bill in question, which is currently going through Parliament, would give the police in England and Wales more power to impose conditions on non-violent protests. Those convicted under the proposed legislation could also face fines or jail term. Anger is already boiling in the country over police violence during a recent vigil held for a woman kidnapped and murdered by an officer. Police have faced widespread outrage over their handling of the March 13th rallies for victim Sarah Everard. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Robert Carter, who's with us from the British capital, London. Also joining us from Edinburgh, we have writer and political analyst John White. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Robert, please bring us up to speed on these recent demonstrations.
Well, of course, this has been rapidly escalating. The British police, as well as the overall government here, have been heavily criticized for a number of reasons, but things seem to be boiling over now, and this comes after, you know, over a year of what's been seen as largely ridiculous and flawed leadership by the government on various issues, including handling of the coronavirus outbreak. But ultimately, the reason that the police are being so heavily criticized and deemed as an enemy of the people now is that it appears as if the country is rapidly turning towards a kind of police state scenario. Now, what that means is there is new legislation in place and going to be put in place in the future, quite possibly, that will ultimately stop people from having their democratic rights to go out and protest and gather in numbers to criticize government policy and things like that. Also, you have the recent incident where a woman was attacked, viciously attacked by what was a member of the police force as well. So the reputation of the Met is at an all-time low. And fueled with all of the rest that's going on in British society right now, it seems as if we're on a boiling pot now. The people have largely had enough, and I think that ultimately things are now reaching a point where, you know, if there isn't some significant reforms made soon, combined with the fear factor that people have that there is a conspiracy against the people, that the government is using the coronavirus crisis to create like a fascist police state of some kind, it's going to lead to more tensions, and unfortunately these types of scenes are probably not going to be a rarity going forward. We could see this type of thing happening more and more often as large protest groups continue to try and tackle against government restrictions on freedom to protest, freedom to gather outside, that type of thing.
John White, do you agree with our correspondent in London? Maybe these protests won't be dying down anytime soon.
I agree in every particular with what Robert just articulated there. On this very station a couple of days ago, I predicted on this issue a long, hot summer of social unrest would occur in response to this outrageous new crime policing bill. But I was wrong, because the social unrest has already begun before summer has arrived. When injustice becomes normalised and legalised, then this is the inevitable result. You don't have to condone violence in order to understand it. And of course, establishment gatekeepers have a vested interest in not understanding it. The author of last night's unrest was Priti Patel, the UK Home Secretary, and her colleagues, who are trying to arrogate to the police frightening new powers that would not look out of place in Benito Mussolini's fascist Italy in the 1930s. And something's got to give. It's not just about this. This is the catalyst. This is the straw that breaks the camel's back. We've had the catastrophic handling of COVID, as Robert articulated there, the criminal negligence, the corruption at the top, with the handing out of billions and pounds of contracts to their friends in the private sector, using COVID as a pretext, rising levels of inequality, poverty, child hunger, a government that's using its 80-seat majority in Parliament to push through horrific pieces of legislation. The hubris is off the scale, and this, as I say, is an inevitable result. And I draw parallels here with the poll tax, because in the last analysis, riots do work, despite what, as I say, establishment gatekeepers claim to the contrary. The poll tax in the early 90s, another piece of regressive Tory legislation, did not end. It was ended by social unrest.
Robert, is there any way that these protests, the message, will be received by London? Are officials going to be listening to what the protesters are demanding and what they have to say right now?
Well, to be honest, the government reaction so far has been pretty typical of the Conservative Party, which is they've sided with the police almost totally, which you'd expect from the government, but ultimately they're making an effort to demonise the protesters, some rightfully. Violence, of course, should never be condoned, but an effort to understand why the violence is taking place is absolutely not on the cards. Priti Patel has condemned the troubles outright, and again, they're putting a typical politician spin on the situation, so ultimately it's the government's fault. The police are essentially there to do their job, you could argue, but the government has not been holding people to account. They're plagued with corruption. They're hated by the public, and ultimately, their reaction to what has taken place—the police officer that has been exposed for crimes against women and that type of thing—their reaction has been pretty poor so far. So it hasn't built any confidence from the public as to believe, okay, what's the government going to do about this? And the public have said they've had enough. So ultimately, it's the government versus the people. That's how they want it, and that's how they're treating it. And that's why it's quite possible that things will continue to escalate, because the government is prepared to essentially go to war with its own people on this very issue, rather than trying to approach it in an understanding fashion. It's just typical Conservative Party leadership.
Mr. White, what do you think on the same issue? Do you think that the message of these protests will be heard by London?
Well, most definitely. I predict that this will be rescinded, because they've already delayed the voting on after the elections in May because of the backlash that it met. Just up to these riots, or this riot, the vigil that you mentioned in commemorating the abduction and the murder of Sarah, allegedly by a serving police officer, and the way the police handled that, that's just fed into a rising tide of disaffection with the government. They're taking on all classes of people at the same time. They did this, as I said, Bolt Act in the early 1990s. It affected every single class, so united middle class, working class people against the government. They've done the same again. This is overreach. It's typical Tory party arrogance. They think that they can do anything they want. They think that the public will buy into it. They think they can wave the union flag and play to the red wall sentiment vis-a-vis Brexit. But that can only, they can only dine out on that for so long. And British obscurantisms and the Second World War and the likes of Winston Churchill for so long. People are waking up to the reality of their condition. We've had a prolonged lockdown that's been ineffective. We've got the highest death toll of COVID in Europe. This is not a government. It's a death cult to be one.
All right, thanks a lot. John White, writer and political analyst, joining us from Edinburgh. Also thanks to our correspondent, Robert Carter, speaking to us from the British capital, London. Welcome back. Russia's foreign minister has begun a visit to China to hold talks with his Chinese counterpart on a range of bilateral and international issues. Sergei Lavrov's trip comes amid Beijing's and Moscow's heightened tensions with the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden. Both Russia and China are marking the 20th anniversary of their good neighborly and cooperation treaty. Before leaving for Beijing, Lavrov told Chinese media that the two countries should replace the U.S. dollar to protect their economies against Western sanctions. Lavrov added that Western countries led by the U.S. are trying to maintain their domination over the global economy and international politics at any cost, including through sanctions. His comments come after Washington vowed to take fresh anti-Russia measure over its alleged intervention in the U.S. presidential elections. The U.S. is also locked in a spate of disputes with China, including over Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the South China Sea. A Canadian man has gone on trial in China on espionage charges amid strained relations between Ottawa and Beijing. Michael Covert, a former diplomat, has been in custody since December 2019. His hearing in Beijing comes days after a closed-door trial of another Canadian, Michael Spavor. Both were formally charged last June with spying. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau blasted China for holding the trial, quote, in secret. The trials appear to be in retaliation for Canada's arrest of the chief financial officer of Chinese tech company Huawei in 2019 on a U.S. warrant. But China insists the detentions are not linked to the case of Meng Wanzhou, who was under house arrest in Vancouver. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region of South Asia as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people. Please stay with us.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about reports of hype and panic in Pakistan over the repayment of a hefty loan to the United Arab Emirates. Then we explore the impacts of such a move on the economic situation of the debt-ridden country and the future of Imran Khan at the helm of a ship sailing through troubled seas.
In 2021, March was the cruelest month for Pakistan, with April yet to come. Mid-March was the deadline for the repayment of a big slice of a huge loan back to the UAE. Nobody would expect the so-called friend Abu Dhabi to ask for the whopping $1 billion. So the news of the Emirati move sent shockwaves across the country. Deposited with the State Bank of Pakistan, the amount has now reached its maturity, and draining such a volume of money can be the coup de grace for Premier Imran Khan.
Since Abu Dhabi asked Islamabad to repay a $1 billion chunk of its loan, which was due mid-March, there are unconfirmed and sometimes conflicting scenarios about the economic and political future of the country. The $1 billion loan was part of the $6.2 billion initial bailout that helped the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan to avoid default on international debt obligations back in late 2018. Islamabad says the main reason behind the delay in the return of the loan amount is the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on its already weak economy. And it is true. According to the World Bank estimate, amid the pandemic, Pakistan's real GDP growth has shrunk. According to the State Bank of Pakistan, the foreign debt and liabilities of Islamabad have increased to a total of over $115 billion until December 2020. In addition to the colossal damage of such a move on the country's economy, it will have massive political consequences for Pakistan. Imran Khan is under extra pressure now, as its government has received about $7 billion in gross foreign loans itself in only in 2020 to 2021.
There are many reports saying that the top Pakistani officials have made repeated attempts to reach out to the Emirati Crown Prince, seeking a one-year extension to return the loan. Moreover, many people are certain of a rollover, and some believe that it is again China that will come to the rescue. However, none of the scenarios may lead to a more popular Imran Khan.
For a country like Pakistan, with multiple incidences of internal and external conflicts, Imran Khan has come to be a skilled sailor, since the seas of South Asian politics seldom see the calm. Earlier in March, the captain had to garner a vote of confidence from the lower house of parliament, following a surprise electoral defeat on a Senate seat earlier in the week. Khan, who was elected to power in a general election in 2018, is the founder of Pakistan's Tehreek-e-Insaf party that leads a ruling coalition. The party experienced another boost when the Senate elected ruling alliance candidate Sadiq Sanjrani as the chairman of the upper house of parliament. Sanjrani, the incumbent whose candidacy was supported by Imran Khan, received 48 votes, with the opposition's Yusuf Raza Gilani receiving 42. Despite a relatively robust standing in domestic affairs of Pakistan, the fact that the United Arab Emirates has moved to withdraw financial support of Islamabad indicates a widening gap in their bilateral relations. Pakistan doesn't seem to have the money to give back. Therefore, even the prospects of losing such a loaded friend has the ability to induce panic in Pakistan's politics.
Last year, when Saudi Arabia announced a similar demand, Pakistan's all-weather friend China came to Imran Khan's rescue. Thanks to Beijing's handsome help, Pakistan paid back $1 billion out of the $3 billion loan that it had secured back in 2019 to avoid default. Now, many expect China to do another trick and get Pakistan to safe shores again. But why lend money to someone when you're sure of their inability to pay back?
Pakistan's economy is severely dependent on international support. This is why the country is deep in debts with almost no real possibility of payback. The financial assistance packages by Saudi Arabia and the UAE helped Pakistan to buy time to negotiate a deal with the International Monetary Fund, or the IMF. But the implementation of the IMF deal has been itself in limbo for over a year now.
Unfortunately, IMF has totally gripped the economy of Pakistan. And the country, Ministry of Finance and all the financial institutions are acting completely what the IMF want. Because they have, I many times said this, that the IMF have first planted their people. They have given the positions in the current government. There are the key elements and the key figure of the Imran Khan government are the people who were the employees of the IMF previously. So right now, so it's mean that the country economy has been hijacked by IMF. And currently, the situation is getting worse and worse. And if the situation goes on, I think that the country is going towards some sort of the major bankruptcy.
Pakistan returned the Saudi loan by securing three different financing pipelines from China. Beijing gave Islamabad $1 billion as soft loan, a credit swap financing line of $1.5 billion and $500 million commercial loan from the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China. The Chinese assistance helped the State Bank of Pakistan maintain the gross foreign exchange reserves of around $13 billion. Currently, the Pakistani government is trying its best to revive the stalled IMF bailout program. As part of the IMF conditions, the government is amending clauses in the State Bank of Pakistan Act of 1956 on the definitions of the monetary liabilities of the central bank.
The IMF has a plan that how to suck the blood of the people and how they will take all its control into the institutions, because this is a strategy. When IMF want to cripple the economy of any country, or they want to put the country towards a bankruptcy, they use such kind of the tactics. So similarly, if I will give you an example that how what's going on in Lebanon now, that their economy is moving towards the barter system. So that is horrible and alarming. So we can see the similar situation is going in Pakistan, because the major sectors of the economy who were the source and the revenue generation sources, they have almost finished. So in that condition, Pakistan economy has been handicapped by IMF by planting their own people into the Pakistan government.
A rollover may be able to postpone Islamabad's problem for some time, but the media frenzy over the UAE move was indicative of Pakistan's strategic significance in the geopolitical alignments of Asia and the entire world. Saudi and UAE pressure is pushing Pakistan towards China, as well as perhaps Iran and Turkey, something the United States and probably India never like. On the other hand, Washington needs Islamabad to keep its foothold in Afghanistan, which is itself getting closer and closer to China. Pakistan is a centerpiece in many of the regional puzzles that we have today.
The network of political alignments around Pakistan is complex, and any slight shifts can lead to big consequences. The recent row over the return of UAE's loan further proved the case. Pakistan is among the rare countries in the world with cordial ties with both China and the US. Washington needs it for better reach in Afghanistan, and Beijing needs it for access to the Indian Ocean. It is a good partner to its western neighbor Iran, but has a history of adversary against India, which in turn has historically friendly connections with Iran. Saudi Arabia and Iran can't get along together, but both value their relations with Pakistan. It does not seem to be about the money. By playing the money card, the UAE may be just mimicking Saudi gimmicks to threaten the government, force Pakistan into Israeli ties, or whatever manipulation they deem favorable. But no matter their objectives, unexpected changes in dynamic systems don't necessarily lead to favorable results.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to learn more about this, we are joined by Mr. Kamar Cheema. He's a strategic and political analyst. Mr. Cheema, welcome to this show. So, why has the UAE demanded repayment of its $1 billion loan back from the debt-ridden Pakistan? What does Abu Dhabi want to achieve other than its money?
Well, the United Arab Emirates and the Saudi Arabia has demanded the money back. The reason behind is that when they gave the money, obviously Pakistan was not thinking that there could be other things which the Emiratis and the Saudis may ask, and while Pakistan had to lose the financial autonomy was no more with Pakistan, so the Saudis and the Emiratis want to take away our autonomy regarding the foreign policy choices. So what we have learned through the sources is that the Pakistan has been asked to recognize Israel. So while the Pakistani government has decided not to recognize Israel because Pakistan's founding father, Qaid Azam Muhammad Ali Jinnah, has made it clear long ago that we cannot recognize Israel until and unless there is a two-state solution for that. So that was the reason that the Emiratis are trying to pressurize Pakistan, and it's just not the $1 billion which the Emiratis are demanding. The other challenge is that the visas have been banned for the Pakistanis. So the Pakistanis are unable to secure the position in UAE, which the other countries can secure. So this is a kind of a challenge that Pakistan have to face by not recognizing Israel. And we had to lose our foreign policy choices. We have been asked to compromise our foreign policy choices because of this.
Wow, really, something really astonishing. So you talked about Israel, of course, but is Abu Dhabi's move somewhere around removing Imran Khan from power, and will he survive such a political upheaval? What are his options?
Well, Abu Dhabi really doesn't want to remove Imran Khan from the power. He doesn't want this, and they will not try to micromanage in Pakistan's politics. They have not been doing it even in the past. But primarily, the choices for Imran Khan has reduced because when Imran Khan came in power, he had to go to the UAE and to the Saudi Arabia for asking money for the financial challenges we were facing. So, and that was the reason that even the International Monetary Fund gave money to Pakistan, that the Saudis and Emiratis were providing us some of the financial bailout plan. So they don't want Imran Khan to come go out of the power, but definitely they want that we should compromise on our foreign policy. For example, Pakistan didn't go to Malaysia when there was a session that was called by Mahathir Mohamad, the former Prime Minister of the Malaysia, to have a session parallel than the OIC. And at the same time, Pakistan has been asked to, that Pakistan is asking the Emiratis and the Saudis to call a special session of the foreign ministers of the Muslim countries so that they can talk on Kashmir. But unfortunately, rather calling calling that particular session, we have been facing challenges, and that challenges are that we have been asked to not to rely or not to depend on any kind of foreign policy bailout from the Emiratis and the Saudis.
Mr. Cheema, our team has collected a few global media coverages in this regard, and I would appreciate if you could just take a look, and then we can continue. Thanks.
Earlier this year, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and Pakistan reached a staff-level agreement to release $500 million US dollars as part of the larger loan pact. The year 2019 saw the international financial institution agreeing to provide a $6 billion US dollar loan to the country to rein in the debt crisis in exchange for reform measures. The Pakistani currency hit over a one-year high at 156.99 rupees against the US dollar in the interbank market in mid-March, as flow of foreign currencies remained high compared to outflows. The inflows have kept the currency's foreign currency reserve stable at a 13-month high of $13 billion and strengthened Islamabad's capacity to make international payments mainly on import and foreign debt repayment counters. The analyst said the latest recovery in rupee was partially backed by the reports that the UAE would roll over soft loan worth $1 billion to Pakistan. Islamabad was scheduled to pay off the loan last Friday, March 12th, but the transaction did not take place. Pakistan has found itself in stronger standing, with a Saudi-led bloc of Arab nations having managed to mend a rift while maintaining ties with another alliance with Iran and Turkey that is challenging the Saudis' leadership of the Muslim world. After the Pakistan-Arab League rift emerged in August, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates asked Pakistan to repay $4 billion in loans taken out in 2018. Then in December, the UAE suspended the issuance of work visas to Pakistani nationals, a move experts said was designed to pressure Pakistan. Out of the committed $6.2 billion, the UAE disbursed $2 billion. It did not make the $3.2 billion oil financing facility and also withheld last $1 billion cash disbursements. Finance Ministry sources had told the Express Tribune that less disbursements by the UAE as against the commitments were because of Pakistan's decision to avail $500 million cash support from Qatar. The UAE has already rolled over $1 billion deposit for another year, which matured in January this year. Despite the drop in global remittances, two of the world's largest recipients of remittances, Pakistan and Bangladesh, registered a rise in flows in 2020 compared with 2019. Pakistanis working abroad sent home more than $2 billion for the eighth consecutive month in January 2021, with Saudi Arabia and the UAE emerging as the biggest contributors to the remittance inflows in recent months. UAE-Pakistan remittances in January 2021 was recorded at $2.3 billion, up by 19% from a year earlier, the country's central bank said. Pakistanis living and working in Saudi Arabia and the UAE contributed the highest inflows during from July 2020 to January 2021, amounting to $7.9 billion in total. A Saudi group that had originally bought the Karachi Electricity Supply Corporation, now called K-Electric, in 2005, has re-entered the scene amid an impasse over the future of the power utility's business relations with the government following the downfall of Arif Naqvi, the British-Pakistani businessman who was the founder and chief executive of the Dubai-based private equity firm, the Abraj Group. The owner of the Al Jomei Holding Company of Saudi Arabia, Sheikh Abdul Aziz Hamad Al Jomei, spent the day on separate meetings with President Arif Alvi, Prime Minister Imran Khan, Ministers for Finance, Energy and Privatization, and some other important stakeholders.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Cheema. So, moving ahead, what are the economic and political consequences of removing such a huge amount from the Pakistani economy?
Well, first of all, it will have a direct impact on the foreign exchange reserve, which is very less at the moment. I think around $14 billion foreign exchange reserves are with the central bank. This is the first economic challenge we will face. Definitely, it will have a challenge for any foreign direct investment because if there is no money in the central bank, all the FDI, they keep on looking the macroeconomic indicators, and the government of Pakistan is trying to keep the macroeconomic indicators in a good position so that they can attract the foreign investors. So this is one thing which is definitely going to be a challenge when it comes to economics. But politically, it will have the impact that Pakistan's Kashmir policy has got weakened because Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and particularly the Saudis and the Emiratis, they are not supporting Pakistan on this particular issue of Kashmir. And since they believe that Pakistan is not taking care of their choices regarding recognizing Israel or making or having a starting a debate in Pakistan about the recognition of Israel, so why to listen to Pakistan on that? And above all, the Emiratis, we have been asked, not by anyone, but we have been asked by some of the quarters in the Middle East that we should not be as neutral as we are when it comes to Iran as well. So particularly, I believe that Pakistan's political choices will further be compromised because Pakistan wants to keep a position of neutrality in Middle East, particularly in the Saudi-Iran impasse.
Okay, Mr. Chima, the UAE's call happened only after a few months after a similar measure by Saudi Arabia. Are they connected?
Well, it seems that that there is some kind of a connection between the Emiratis and the Saudis on this, because personally, I find that the Saudis were not happy when Pakistan took a stance that Pakistan is not going to recognize Israel. So, and at the same time, we were not supporting the Emiratis and the Saudis on when they waged a war in Yemen. And Pakistan's parliament decided that we are not going to send the troops in Yemen and there will not be any boots on the ground. So this was a very turning point where the Emiratis were not very much happy on this. And somehow the GCC and these Arab countries, they try to have a unified policy on Pakistan, because Pakistan talks to all of these for a support on Kashmir issues. So, and we wanted a collective support from the platforms like Organization of Islamic Cooperation and from the GCC, but unfortunately we couldn't. So there is some kind of a unity between the Saudis and the Emiratis.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chima. Unfortunately, it marks the end of our show. And thank you for your very commendable comments. People have voiced their opinion on social media and cyberspace. And let's just take a quick look.
Faisal Ali Shah said on his Twitter post, "Very challenging situation for Pakistan. UAE demands loan back at the same time as defense and others deal with agreements signed between Israel and UAE. Keep in mind, Pakistan is under pressure also to join Arab-Israel alliance against Iran." Mayank Jindal believes that UAE announces $10 billion fund for investments in Israel after a phone call between Mohammed bin Zayed and Netanyahu. Zayed says $1 billion will come from Pakistan as loan reimbursement and $9 billion will be scheduled investments. Tarun Khanna reacts on his Twitter account and says, "I wonder who will help Imran Khan to pay back the loans and which territory of Pak will be kept at stake." Mansi believes that UAE is behaving like an old Hindi film zamindar who just wants to have the poor farmer's land and house in return for the loan the farmer took from them. Muslim Brotherhood is dead, it seems. Poor Pakistan.
And that was our episode about the aftershocks of the UAE request for repayment of its big loan from Pakistan and the political dynamics of economic ties between Abu Dhabi and Islamabad. We shall meet next week.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا
your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. By Sayyid Wahid Alawi. An Islamic scholar with 16 years of Hawza studies.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome once again to IRIB English Radio and the program For Humanity. We were talking about one of the rights in the book, The Treatise of Rights of Imam Ali Zainul Abidin, The Adornment of the Believers, Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhim as-salam. In this right, I will talk about the right of him whose advice you seek. The right of him whose advice you seek. In it, Imam Ali Zainul Abidin alayhi salam says, "And the right of him whose advice you seek is that you should not accuse him when he gives you advice which does not conform to your own opinion. It is quite natural that opinions are divergent, and people have various views about their affairs in which they disagree. You are free not to accept his advice if you doubt it. However, you are not permitted to accuse him of providing you with ill advice as long as you consider him to be of those worthy of consultation. Do not stop thanking him for the thoughts and the good advice he has given you. And if it was appropriate for you, you should thank Allah for it. Accept it from your religious brother with gratitude and be ready to act similarly for him if one day he should seek your advice. And there is no power but in Allah." Thus says Imam Ali Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. And as we talked about the need for consultation, which in Arabic is mushawara, we will continue, inshallah, in this topic to talk more about the rights of him whose advice you seek. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the noble Quran, "And when you have decided, then rely upon Allah. Indeed, Allah loves those who rely upon him." As Muslims, for us, the best role model we have is, of course, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. And he was the living Qur'an. "And indeed, you are of a great moral character," says the noble Qur'an about him. And as the living Qur'an, he follows all the commandments of Allah better than anyone else. And we see that the Prophet followed mushawara, consultation, or he seeked advice from the Sahaba, from the companions, over and over again. He also seeked consultation and advice from his wife Ummul Mu'mineen Khadijatul Kubra Salamullah Alayha. The noble Quran says, "Consult them in the matter, and when you have decided, then rely upon Allah. Indeed, Allah loves those who rely upon him." So we see that the Prophet consulted over and over again the companions in different occasions, as we have mentioned before, the peace treaty of Hudaybiyah, the different battles, the battle of Badr, the battle of Uhud, the battle of Khandaq, the ditch, and so on and so forth. And the environment that dominated among the companions was an environment which was friendly. People were not afraid to say their opinion to the Prophet, and the Prophet gave them that feeling. And as we see what Imam Ali Zainul Abidin alayhi salam says, in the book, the Treatise of Rights, he says, you should not accuse him when he gives you advice which does not conform to your own opinion. Sometimes the companions would give different opinions which the Prophet did not have the same opinion of. He had another opinion, but he followed the majority view, for example, in the battle of Uhud. But the thing is that you see this friendly environment. He did not insult anyone. The environment was completely full of friendship and love. And inshallah, we'll continue with this topic after the break. So please join us afterwards.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to the program For Humanity. And we were talking about one of the rights in the book, The Treatise of Rights of Imam Ali Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, the right of him whose advice you seek. In it, Imam Ali Zainul Abidin alayhi salam says, وَأَمَّا حَقُّ الْمُشِيرِ إِلَيْكِ فَلَا تَتَّهِمْهُ بِمَا يُوقِفُكَ عَلَيْهِ مِنْ رَأْيِهِ. You should not accuse him when he gives you advice which does not conform to your own opinion. And we see that this sunnah was established by the Prophet himself. Allah actually commands the Prophet to establish this beautiful sunnah, where he consulted others to establish this sunnah in the ummah, in the community. Even in domestic affairs between a husband and a wife, we see that the Prophet seek the advice of Ummul Mu'mineen Khadija or Ummul Mu'mineen Umm Salama. Further, Imam Ali Zainul Abidin says, you are not permitted to accuse him of providing you with ill advice as long as you consider him to be of those worthy of consultation. Here Imam Sajjad alayhi salam says that if someone gives you an advice which is the opposite of your opinion, you should not see him, that person X, as someone who is no more reliable in your eyes. You should not have a bad opinion and avoid any kind of bad thoughts about a person who has given an advice which you didn't like. This saying of the Imam, you should not accuse him when he gives you advice which does not conform to your opinion, and you are not permitted to accuse him of providing you with ill advice as long as you consider him to be of those worthy of consultation, has the backing of the Quran, which says in Al-Hujarat chapter 49 verse 12, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, O you who believe, avoid most suspicion. Some suspicion is sinful, and do not spy on one another, nor backbite one another. The noble Quran says, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا اِجْتَنِبُوا كَثِيرًا مِنَ الظَّنِّ إِنَّ بَعْدَ الظَّنِّ إِثْمٌ. One of the conditions of iman, of faith, is that you should avoid suspicion towards others. Most surely is suspicion one of the moral diseases that a human being can get, and is seen as pure oppression towards the one which is afflicted with your suspicion. So we pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala helps us in this great, great obligation that we have, and that we can avoid suspicion and these diseases, these moral diseases that can afflict all of us. Ilahi Ameen. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you. As always, you can forward your questions or suggestions to us to our email address, which is englishradio@irib.ir. And you can also listen to us through parstoday.com. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Salli ya Rabbi ala Taha al-Amin, rahmatin arsaltahu lil alamin, wa ala alin nabiyyi ajma'in, fa bihim narjuka ahsin khatmina.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.